There are only 9 new episodes left before Star Trek Voyager's series finale. They were abducted, their memories erased.
My employee number is 8586.
Now, how will the crew return to Voyager when they don't know who they really are?
They're not going to leave willingly.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the primary reactor core,
this is Tyler Orton, chuckling like a yokel at cartoons that aren't really all that funny.
That moment was so weird, but we'll get to that later. In depth. This week, we are going to talk about the Voyager two-parter, the last of the two-parters we're going to cover before we get to the end game.
Wow.
We're going to talk about Workforce, the season 7 two-parter, the one that really was the confident, you know,
just. We're 7 seasons in. We can do whatever we want.
Pointing and swinging. Let's go out with a bang before the finale kind of two-parter.
Cam, I think probably the easiest thing for us to do is take part one first, part two after that. But let's first talk about our initial reactions to this one. How did you feel a couple years ago the first time you ever saw Workforce, parts 1 and 2?
Yeah, okay, my memories of this one are, what I would sometimes do when I was cycling through Voyager, TNG, whatever, I would read like the one sentence plot synopsis on IMDb, because I'd be scrolling ahead like, oh, do I have a good episode next or do I have a lousy one? Because, you know, you look at the user scores.
Yeah.
And I remember reading the synopsis for Workforce and being like, oh, this does not sound like the most enjoyable of sits. And so I did not go into it like, hooray, hooray, here comes a great Voyager two-parter that I've heard about.
What was the user score around, do you recall?
I think it was like 7.8 or something. Like, it wasn't bad.
Okay.
It was totally fine.
Yeah.
You know, Voyager tends to skew a little lower in grades than, say, TNG does.
Everything's a perfect 10, going back to Code of Honor.
Exactly. And I watched Workforce, and, like, I didn't have a negative reaction to it. I didn't have an overly positive reaction. I thought it was fine. It was just weird in that it's so ingrained in us from watching Star Trek two-parters to walk out with like a strong opinion on something, whether it's an iconic moment, whether it's a cliffhanger, whether it's just the concept of the two-parter. And I don't really think I had anything to do with that with Workforce. I was just like, yeah, that was a Voyager story. And so, plus, also to be fair, at that point, I'm also counting down to the end, right? You know, you're cycling through season 7. You're just looking forward to seeing how this all wraps up. So that doesn't help either.
For me, I had a tough time answering this question because I remembered barely anything from this episode. The image that sticks with me most is Janeway walking around this really cosmopolitan alien city.
Yeah.
In her awesome jumpsuit.
The sparkly blue one?
Yes.
Yeah.
There were so many elements that I had just completely forgotten about through this that we're going to dive into. So for me, this was totally not an episode I was looking forward to rewatching.
I think we dropped enough mentions of it on the podcast.
We're kind of making fun of it
to a certain degree. A little bit, yeah.
But maybe I'll jump into this, but my reaction, you know, years, Cam, it's probably been 15 years, no, more than 15 years since I watched this.
Right.
I kind of was delighted by this one. It was a surprisingly entertaining, low-key sort of two-parter.
Yeah.
Surprisingly low-key, but you know what? It works for me, and we can get into the reasons a lot more in just a second here, but upon your rewatch, what was your initial reaction now?
I, again, found it kind of low-key entertaining in the first part. I have some issues we're going to bring up throughout, but I found the second part less engaging this time in that, you know, you spend a lot of time with just trying to wait for characters to get with the program, essentially, which gets a little old. But no, I was, I guess, fine with it. It's just like, it's so low wattage for a two-parter.
Yeah.
And that's the weird thing. And I have to go back to, I wonder if it's a two-parter because the sets were expensive. But I will say, like, this definitely feels very almost TOS-y to me, where, like, you know, the original series, you go down to a planet and there's a gimmick to the planet. This is very much that. It's like, what if you had a whole planet that was just like working in a factory or whatever?
I'll tell you the main reason why this one actually jumps out to me and I was engaged by it is that almost, I think, actually, no. every single character from the cast had something to do.
Yeah.
That's something that we've complained a lot about every single other two-parters. Like, inevitably, you're going to get a cast member that's just totally neglected.
Yeah.
What exactly was Kes up to in, say, Basics?
Sure.
You know, that sort of issue.
I guess Neelix got the short end of the stick probably in this one, but he still had stuff to do.
Well, there's some beautiful moments that he had in, say, part two, B'Elanna, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And or even part one where he's, you know, part of the investigative team. We even get a name drop of his own vessel that's still in the Voyager shuttle bay, you know? So even Neelix, who I agree with you, he got the short end of the stick. They were still giving him some gems to do throughout this episode. And for me, I always am drawn to Star Trek because of the character stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is a good character episode. And the fact that we're getting it in what's supposed to be kind of an explosive two-part episode, and they focus so much on character stuff in Voyager, which sometimes they like to go more for the action stuff.
Yeah,
I'm kind of delighted by this one in a way that I never really expected to be. And I think, look, 17 years has been like a nice kind of buffer for me to think about it, as opposed to being in that era where, hey, it's season 7. I am just waiting for this series to wrap up. How much finality am I going to feel?
Yeah.
And I think they push that a little bit with like a lot of talk about home, like what is home and how this planet could feel like home if your memories are changed fundamentally, and why there's kind of this maybe driving urge behind, you know, the 130 plus members of this crew that still need to get to home.
It was also nice to see Chakotay in an active role.
I was going to say that, yes.
Yeah, as opposed to just sitting on, you know, in his chair, fiddling with his console.
Don't we both kind of agree at this point that two-part episodes are generally the best showcases for Chakotay, like, on a more consistent level? Why is it that they really want to go all out with Chakotay?
I don't know. It's like they wait until two-parters to introduce either conflict between him and Janeway, or to give him something really active to do.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think of Chakotay episodes that are just single episodes, like, which ones stand out to you? He has, like, Tattoo, which is, like, the origin story. There's the one with the, like, the military. Do you remember that? Where, like, he's, like, joins, like, a militia or something?
Vaguely.
Yeah. My memories of it are very vague, so I apologize to anyone who knows that episode really well.
He had a beautiful episode. I think Virginia Madsen was playing the love interest.
Is it Unforgettable?
Yes, Unforgettable.
That's actually a really good one.
For me, like maybe a top 10 Voyager episode.
Yeah.
And
Not according to our top 10s that we did on Voyager.
But oh, okay.
It's up there. It was number 11.
I love it. I love how you could like dig right back into my memory and be like, sorry, Tyler. But it's such an underrated episode. I'd encourage everybody to go back and rewatch that one there.
Yeah.
When they give him stuff to do, Robert Beltran is actually really good. But the problem is if you've got this guy reading like exposition about like the shields are at 80%, there's only so much this dude can do.
Yeah.
Watching him kind of become action hero Chakotay, but you know what, for me, spoiler alert, going to part two, just skipping ahead, the moments with him and Janeway in her apartment, just some of the best stuff, and you can really feel that there is this chemistry between Mulgrew and Beltran that I think they just didn't quite always go to that well enough, you know? Like, it would have worked so much more if they had done that more than just in those two-part episodes, like, say, this or Scorpion, for example.
I never really understood why they didn't exploit Beltran a little more, just in terms of, like, his physical abilities. Because, you know, you look at Riker, they're like, okay, we cast Jonathan Frakes, he's a young guy, he's in good shape, he can do more of, like, the action-type stuff, as opposed to Picard, until we get to the movies. And then Patrick Stewart's like, get out of my way.
He is ripped in First Contact when he is like pulling himself up that Jeffries tube. Yeah. You're like, holy moly, Patrick Stewie.
He's like bench pressing Jonathan Frakes. But like Robert Beltran was in really good shape at this point in his life too. I mean, not to say he isn't now, but I mean, he really was at this point. And I think he was even doing like some photo layouts really showing that off. And Voyager does not give him physical activity to do very often on the show. And it's like, why? Why not exploit that? Like, you've got this guy who can do, maybe be more like the action hero type. If you've got Janeway doing a lot of the bridge stuff and kind of the den mother. And she gets, you know, action hero stuff doing like Macrocosm. But like, Chakotay doesn't get enough.
Do you think he's endearing himself at this point with the writers when he's going to all these conventions at the time? And he's literally saying, the writing on Voyager is garbage.
Yeah.
Like, the thing is, like, about once a month, we would read stories. Like, back in the day, I was on, like, the old websites, and you'd have Robert Beltran saying, like, Voyager writing is garbage. And the thing is, like, I have my issues with Voyager, but when they gave him something good to do,
yeah,
it was good. It was engaging to watch. He was a great performer when they gave him something to do. We kind of mocked Chakotay as being kind of dull, mm-hmm. but I feel bad for the actor because they just, it used to have to always be shields are at 80% now.
Yeah.
I'm just like, okay.
If you were to ask the writers, where do you think they would rank Chakotay in terms of the cast? Because it's always tough because it's alphabetical cast listings. You know, it's not like the original series where you really knew where everyone stood.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wonder because obviously, you know, you've got Janeway and Seven and the Doctor seem higher up.
Let's rank it right now.
Okay.
Janeway number one, right?
Yeah.
Do you put Seven at number two or the Doctor at number two?
And it depends on the era, right?
Let's think about it holistically over seven seasons.
Yeah.
Though.
Seven is probably number two.
I agree. Okay. And so then Doc at number three.
Yeah.
Do you think Tom Paris is number four then?
I think you can make a pretty strong argument for that because he does have a lot of showcase episodes.
Okay. So let's say Tom Paris tentatively number four. Who would be like a number five? Is it Chakotay?
Okay. Well, let's now compare Chakotay versus B'Elanna. I think Chakotay probably has more to do.
Maybe a little bit more?
Maybe
I don't know.
Maybe a little more? I don't know.
You know, he has the benefit of being on the bridge.
Yes.
Okay, so let's give it to Chakotay for number five.
He's above Neelix.
Yeah.
And he's above Kes, and he's above Harry Kim, so I would probably put,
B'Elanna at number six then, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so number seven, is it Neelix at that point? I think it has to be Neelix.
Well, I would say because of the fact there was the point where they were going to cut a cast member and, Harry
Kim was in the mix.
Yeah, Garrett Wong was up. That tells me he's not that high up.
Yeah.
So I think he's near the bottom.
Okay, so Kim number seven.
Yeah.
Or sorry, Neelix number seven.
Yeah.
So the number eight is
Harry
Kim. And then number nine, Kes?
Well, it depends because Kes is a different era. Like, I would probably bump Kes ahead of Kim in the era that she's there.
But let's think about it holistically.
Yeah, she's below him.
Yeah, so Kim number eight.
Oh, we forgot Tuvok.
So were there 10 cast members? I thought there were 9. Yeah. There must be. Okay. Yeah. So we left off with, remind me again.
Well, do you put...
But B'Elanna was number 6, I know that.
Yeah.
And then Neelix was number 7.
Yeah.
So number 8 was, would you say Tuvok above Kim?
Yes.
Okay, so then that's... Sorry, are we on number 7 now?
Now I'm just getting confused.
Okay, we'll go B'Elanna, Neelix, Tuvok, Kim, Kes. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Okay,
yeah.
You do the math, listeners.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're clearly not math students here.
English major.
Yeah, political science and history major.
That's
myself.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting. So what exactly was the point of this exercise?
I think the point was just trying to determine where
so he's
Robert Beltran ranks.
He's in the middle.
You know, like in terms of the writers when they're sitting down with their season, how focused they are on giving Chakotay a lot to do.
So is he the lowest ranked first officer in all of the franchises then? If he's right in the middle. You've got Spock is the dedicated number two.
Yep, Kira,
Riker is the number two. I'd say Kira's the number two. I would say T'Pol is the number two.
Yeah.
And at this point with Star Trek Discovery, what's that? That's an interesting question, though. You know, if we think about season one, Lorca is the captain.
Yeah.
Saru, would you put him at... I'd put Saru in the middle in season one.
Yeah.
Where would you put Saru in season two?
Higher up. considerably higher.
Tilly is higher than Saru in season one, but I think Saru is higher than Tilly in season two.
Correct, yeah.
I agree. We do see Saru on an ascending trajectory. So, unfortunately for Beltran, I think he's the lowest ranked first officer.
Do you think that was going to be the intention straight out of the gate? Do you
think I don't think so. No.
Yeah, you think originally they wanted.
If you go back and watch Caretaker, which I still think is the best Star Trek pilot we've ever had, just setting up all the potential. I think what they wanted to do is have a lot of tension between Janeway and Chakotay, and I think that he was going to be kind of the launching point for that.
Yeah.
I think he was supposed to be kind of the next Riker sort of figure, not necessarily in persona, but just screen time.
Right.
They did away with that, I think, by episode two, though.
I know.
It's so unfortunate.
I always laugh about that episode where he's like yelling at the crew members for kissing in the turbo lift.
And you know what? Janeway with, again, I'll jump ahead to... You know, episode two of Workforce, though, she makes a point to Jaffin, her love interest, like, I would love to have you as an engineer aboard the ship, but I am the captain. There can't be any fraternizing here. And I feel for Mulgrew when she made a very good case to the writers, like, she is the captain. She can't have ongoing relationships with anybody who's a crew member. And I think that impacted maybe the development of Chakotay to a certain degree.
Right.
There's so much obvious chemistry between Beltran and Mulgrew.
There's that early episode where the two of them are on the planet together.
Yeah.
And, like, they set up, you know, like, a living quarters and all that. And it's a fantastic episode, at least in terms of the chemistry between the two of them. So, you know, I can totally see how it birthed a lot of fan fiction.
I think that episode name, it was...
I'm not even going to guess.
I think it starts with a C.
Okay.
That's what I can remember most.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I know. Or it starts... Or is it, like, Life Signs or something? It's not
no,
Life...
No, it's not Life Signs. That's the one with the Vidian doctor.
Okay. But anyways, I'm sure listeners are fascinated by this. But I think that's a beautiful episode, though.
It is, yeah.
But it really kind of stuck a fork in kind of the potential of them becoming love interests. And I think it would have been great. I honestly think, look, you're, what, 70 years presumably on your own?
Yeah.
I think you can kind of break some of the rules set aside in Starfleet. But I totally understand Mulgrew making the case to the writers, especially being like the first female captain.
Right.
How good does it actually reflect on her if that's what she's doing? Because there is like this power dynamic and totally legitimate. But then again, like Chakotay's not at this point in time a Starfleet officer. He is a member of the Maquis, even though he once did serve in Starfleet. I think they could have gotten away with it. I think you could have rationalized it somehow. And I think it's Beltran's loss personally.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that.
Yeah. Okay, so should we start with Workforce Part 1?
Yes.
Okay. Look, you start the episode off with Mulgrew and Janeway on kind of this journey through this pretty cool planet that just is showcasing the VFX talent from, like, almost 20 years ago.
Yeah, there's a scene of, like, the big, long, like, elevator going down, which was a tribute to the movie Forbidden Planet, actually.
Oh, okay.
I think it's on the special feature, there's a hidden special feature on the DVD. And they talk about that shot.
We've discussed Forbidden Planet on this very podcast. Maybe you put a link to that in the blog. We've actually even done a live panel in Las Vegas dedicated to how film has influenced Star Trek. And Forbidden Planet was one of the big deals there. The other thing that jumps out to me, though, is I say the characters got a lot to do. Mm-hmm. Tuvok is drunkenly laughing
at
a bar.
He's like, hearty laugh. I wrote hearty laugh in my notes. It's like, this is amazing.
Yeah. So what the first few moments of the show is setting up, though, is like, hey, you know the familiar crew here? Mm-hmm. All's not right here. Something's rotten in Denmark, I should say. And so I think it's kind of a good way to jump off with the start of the show and make you question what's going on here.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of doing all the stuff that, like, two-parters should be doing here.
Well, it's definitely taking a concept that's outside the norm for the show and just throwing you right in and making it feel, like, immersive, but also bigger than your average episode, even though it's not like a big, you know, like slam bang fireworks and all that sort of two-parter. It just feels different. It's kind of like almost like a Times Arrow where it's just like the story that just exists outside of the normal run of a, you know, standard Voyager episode. And that gives it a lot of novelty. And I just like do appreciate, you know, the shots of Janeway on the catwalks, you know, going to work. It just kind of creates the whole world of her just journeying to her job, and it sets it all up. Now I have a lot of questions later that I want to get into in terms of the actual
world.
Like, yes, the world,
like,
itself,
the most boring bar world that they all want to congregate at. what would be more boring, 10 forward or this particular bar?
More people go to 10 forward.
More people go to 10 forward, which, look, I think we love the set of 10 forward.
Yeah.
But there's maybe three people hanging out in 10 forward any given time except for Star Trek Generations where it is packed shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah.
It's kind of a snoozer of a bar. Like, Quark's bar is the place I want to be.
Yeah.
Tom's bar, which apparently he takes over entirely by episode 2.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. But
it was weird because I thought Iona Morris, who played the bartender in part 1, she was like really interesting.
Yes.
And she's actually has a bit of a Trek lineage. She was she was one of the kids in Miri.
Really?
Yes.
Who is she? Do you recall? I'm putting you on the spot.
She was just like one of the young kids there.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
She's not a major role. I don't think her character is referred to by a name in the credits.
Okay.
I think they
She wasn't the bully?
No, she wasn't.
the redheaded boy.
She's actually the sister of Phil Morris, who's been on Star Trek a lot.
Right. Okay.
And Iona Morris is also the voice of Storm on the 1990s X-Men show.
Did you not see her at a panel in Vegas?
I did last year.
Was it last year?
Yeah,
that's right. I missed out on that one. I was totally bummed you were giving me the recap on it.
They didn't really talk about Voyager much.
Really? Okay.
Which is weird.
That's what I think of Phil Morris is his role on Voyager more than
anything. He got asked questions about Voyager.
Oh, okay.
But, like, she didn't really get a lot of questions about Voyager. She answered more questions about, like, Miri and things like that.
Hmm.
And then, of course, X-Men. But, I thought she was really great. Like, that character really popped right out of the gate. And I was actually kind of surprised they didn't do more with her.
It's unfortunate. Because there's so much kind of potential that she had.
Yeah.
I think maybe you're just, by the time you get to part two and you're trying to resolve everything, maybe you're just trying to, cull the number of supporting characters that are on the show.
Probably.
Because they actually introduce a lot of supporting characters in part two.
Yeah.
But look, we end up on this planet. I kind of feel as if I understand this world. And honestly, any chance for Janeway to hook up?
Yeah.
I am down for that.
Okay. This is where I kind of have issues, though. Like, I have no problem with the flirtation between her and Jarrett. Was it Jaffin?
Jaffin.
But I never quite understood the passage of time from when they're, like, flirting to moving in.
3 weeks. They established that in episode two, and I jumped out of my seat going, like, you're moving in after 3 weeks?
It's really weird. And, I mean, I don't know that he's the most charismatic Star Trek love interest.
No, Cam. Can I give you a Jaffin quote right
yes,
here?
Yes, you may.
If we were to combine our resources, we would reduce expenses. This is how he asks her to move in.
I use that line all the time. In fact, it's on my Tinder profile.
Okay. Finish off the Jaffin because I do have some thoughts that might actually differ from yours, but go for it. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like this is a story, like their romance would mean more if there was more of a sense of a real passage of time.
Yeah.
You kind of get these awkward meet cute type stuff, the seduction over the bad food. And you're like,
he makes it very clear that her cooking sucks.
Yeah.
Cam, I've never had a meal so bad that I can't put a smile on my face.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I could eat like anything. If I was on like, was that their first date?
Yeah.
Yeah. If I'm on a first date and I'm like into this person, it doesn't matter what they serve. I'd be like, oh God. Okay.
Yeah. Your date could be the vendor from that episode of Simpsons where they went to New York and she's going, growl kolosh.
Right. Yeah.
You'd be like, yum.
Yeah, exactly. I would just be like, okay, just swallow. Don't you just like try not to taste anything.
Yeah.
But he's just like, yeah, this is bad.
Alien culture. Maybe it's just his thing. You know, I can't judge too much.
Yeah. But like, what I guess I like about him is he feels like someone who is a contemporary of Janeway. Like, he doesn't feel like...
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I'm on the same page here.
Because there's other love interests we've talked about in Star Trek that just are super weak.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the Troi ones are just weak. Like, the Troi ones seem often dim. Whereas I think of Troi as a very bright character, and it's these guys who are really boring and bland and kind of dim.
And totally into the... masculine toxicity.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
If not worse.
Or toxic masculinity. I kind of switched that
around,
but it still works.
Sure. But I do like that this guy does feel like her equal in a lot of ways. And I don't know. The only thing I have is I feel like he's just written to be not that interesting.
So I'll say this. We've complained a lot in these Voyager two-parters about how they hired generic 90s man for all these prominent roles.
Yeah.
This guy... He actually stands out to me. Like, he doesn't look like that same generic 90s man. He's actually got, like, a little bit of a distinct look to him where it's like, you know, whether it's like a little gray in his hair, a little bit more of a weathered face. Like, it doesn't look as if he got his hair cut in 1992.
Yeah.
Like, I can kind of find him to be a more distinct character. I don't necessarily think it's great that he's trying to gaslight Janeway when she is saying, hey, this man comes up to me and says that we're good friends and I'm a captain of a ship.
Yeah.
He's like, of course he would say that.
Yeah.
That's not a great thing. It's very much a remnant of 1990s TV even like contemporary TV of like men trying to gaslight women.
Right.
So I do have issues with him, but I think it's like a much better love interest than like 90% of what Janeway's had. I still think that the best one is Counterpoint, the inspector.
Oh, by far.
From Counterpoint.
Yeah. That guy's fantastic.
Yeah. So,
do you think this actor, was it James Reed, I think? Yeah, James Reed.
Yep.
Do you think he was up for the character in 1159? the Janeway's ancestor dated, because they feel to me like they came from a similar casting call.
I think he's a far more attractive dude.
I wasn't going to put the other guy down.
Kevin Tai?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I can buy him playing that role as the bookkeeper, or sorry, the bookstore owner.
Sure.
It would totally work for me. And I don't know. What if Kevin Tai was playing Jaffin in this episode? I don't think that would necessarily translate. Yeah. I think this is a James Reed is a much better casting choice for Jaffin at this point.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is it a little awkward now to watch like the scenes of him like hurling himself at Janeway in the workplace where you're like, oh boy, it definitely was the 90s.
Yeah.
That would not fly today. You
can't get away with that. It's not cool, guys.
Yeah.
So, but look, we also get to see other characters kind of established, like, say, what is Annika Hansen, as she now going
like
by?
Supervisor.
Yeah, I can totally buy her.
Oh, hell yeah. This made total sense that she's the very strict supervisor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're talking about putting people in different roles. Just think about it. The doctor. He's, again, going to the ECH. He's the emergency command hologram. This, to me,
yeah, for the second time,
You see Brian Fuller's name on the credits here as one of the writers of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
To me, I'm like, oh, that's such a Brian Fuller idea to put the doctor in that particular role. Like, it just jumps out to me. I think by part two, it got a little, like, annoying with, like, how the doctor was behaving.
Right, yeah.
You know, especially trying to, like, why did Chakotay say to Ensign Harry Kim, who is like a legit Starfleet officer who went to the academy and everything, you guys figure it out. I'm like, no, Harry Kim to me is the captain at that point.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't care how many programs the ECH has in his, in his head.
Yeah.
Harry's in charge.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there a program with the doctor to be like a, I don't know, EEH or an ESH, like for engineer security?
I don't think so.
No?
I think it's just he's got the ECH thing that kind of developed as a result. Tinker Tenor, Dr. Spy.
Right.
Have not touched on that in, what, like two seasons?
Mm-hmm.
I love that they kind of bring it back. It gives the Doctor something interesting to do in an episode. Yeah. Like, otherwise, what would he have been doing in part one?
Sure.
Not much. And I could totally buy him doing a lot in part two because he's trying to help, you know, say, a B'Elanna character and the rest of the crew. So, I don't know. Part one, I like it. I like the ECH presence a lot more.
Yeah, me too.
You know, but it's putting characters in different positions.
Yes.
It's like why we enjoy those body swapping episodes, and that you can see the actors be able to stretch,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they're doing here.
What I liked about the ECH stuff too is we had that episode Message in a Bottle, where it's like the doctor steering a ship, and it's all kind of like wacky hijinks type stuff.
Yeah.
But I like seeing the doctor actually do it competently. Like, it's a different tone than that episode, but I like being able to see the ECH function completely competently and, you know, help his people and, like, take down the engines in that other the pursuing ship. And while I do kind of have issues with, like, Voyager being able to basically be controlled just through voice,
it's sure, like, okay. I know.
The only way I can kind of accept it, maybe, is that the fact that the doctor is a part of the ship's computer.
Okay.
So he's actually tapped into the computer network, perhaps? Like, I don't know.
It's one of the problems that you brought up in an episode we did a couple months ago with, like, kind of mysteries of Star Trek with what happens when the EMH returns to the Alpha Quadrant.
Yeah.
And you've got this doctor who can essentially replace every single doctor that's out there. Why not just copy his program and do everything with it?
Yeah.
It's like, it's one of those issues, and I think it's very prescient that they were dealing with it, but at, you know, this moment in history, we're thinking a lot about, say, automation and how it can really reduce the workforce as we know it, and that's kind of a scary thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe they're tapping into that unknowingly at this point.
So does that mean in the Picard spinoff, the Enterprise is just Picard by himself commanding it?
No, I think it's Picard sitting at home watching everything on a view screen at his vineyard.
The Enterprise is a drone now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fans are just like, this is not the show I thought I would be getting.
No, it's literally a 6-foot-long drone. Wow.
He keeps bumping into things and looking at the screen. He's just like, damn it all.
Yeah. So, look, the Doctor stuff, I'll say that maybe it's not a sustainable thing.
Yeah.
For him to be the ECH on an ongoing basis as he proposed in part two, which that really made me roll my eyes, where he was saying, I don't want to be the doctor anymore. I'm going to be the ECH permanently. And everyone was just like, no, I don't think so. To me, I know that they're doing it as a joke because it's, hey, isn't it funny when the doctor has a huge ego?
Right.
But to me, it's much like that virtuoso problem mm-hmm. where if the doctor is giving up his responsibilities, you know, it means that he doesn't really totally care so much of his duties as a doctor and to take care of the people on the ship. I think it really undercuts the character, makes him kind of sociopathic to a certain degree.
Right, right. Well, he is a computer program.
That's true. That's true. Cam, the other thing that jumps out to me in part one before we jump into part two, though, is how often are you at a bar and a pregnant woman comes in and you put the moves on her? She says, yeah, no, I don't think it's going to work. And you say to her, I want to be your friend. Like, is the Tom and B'Elanna stuff, I know...
It's weird.
I know what they're trying to do in that, like, hey, even despite this memory wipe, like, they still care about each other some way, somehow. Although B'Elanna doesn't really seem to share that.
No. I like when he's all wounded. He's like, I want to introduce you to some parents. I'm like, okay.
I know on the page, it must seem beautiful. But if this were to happen in real life, I just don't think it's realistic. Like, I'm just like, what, like a 35-year-old guy putting the moves on a pregnant woman. It's a little weird.
It's a little strange.
She's in her third trimester.
Why is she hanging out in a bar?
That's the other thing that's really bizarre. You know? And then she's like annoyed that someone's hitting on her.
Yeah.
Well,
it is a quiet bar. Maybe she thought it was the library.
And look, all women have the right to be annoyed by like creepy guys like not taking the hint and leaving them alone. I totally agree with that. But it's just kind of like it was such a weird situation to bring those two characters together again.
It's like they forgot B'Elanna or something. And they're like, oh, how do we tie her into this? I know. Well, Tom's at the bar. So why don't we have her at the bar? Wait, why is she at the bar?
Why is a pregnant woman?
Don't worry about it.
Yeah. She has extra work to do.
Time is money, people. Keep the show rolling.
Yeah. Before we jump to part two, though, I just want to talk to you maybe about kind of one of the more thematic things that they're touching on here. And they're talking about, like, say, the value of labor.
Yeah.
And I like how you mentioned at the top, though, this almost kind of feels like a TOS-era episode where there's kind of a gimmick to the planet, and they're actually addressing, like, an issue within society. And I think in the last 20 years, this is actually becoming an even more, you know, important issue when we see how, you know, the average income has not really moved much at all.
Right.
And we have this more and more transforming into more of a service-based society, so... We see wages being stagnant and the gap between, you know, the lower class and the upper class just widening more and more and more. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of – I like how Star Trek has so much applicability and it can even grow depending on the era. I don't know if I would have gotten much out of this maybe 10 years ago.
Right.
And I don't know if I'll get as much out of it 10 years from now. But I'm watching it at a period of time where it just seems so cutting and just a really good story to watch at this point.
Although I could never really – I don't know. Do you think that the actual jobs in this industry is presented negatively? Obviously, the sense that like they brainwash these people to work there. Yes, all of that stuff, obviously. But in terms of the actual day-to-day in the job...
Like, it's not hard labor.
No.
Yeah.
See, and people keep talking about how they have good jobs.
Yeah.
And they have apartments, too.
Although, they're like, it's curfew.
That's true.
And like, F you. I'd like to walk around my block, please.
Yeah, I could never, like... quite figure out if the show was like coming down on like some sort of capitalist ideal of like what this represents. Because I know this episode was inspired by Metropolis, the Fritz Lang movie.
Okay.
Which is a much more like scathing look at that sort of idea, capitalism and sort of the forces of labor.
Do you think it almost feels like maybe, I don't know, present day mainland China, okay. You know, where it's like, here's your job, go to your job, follow the rules. You have limited freedoms. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the state will provide what you need. Here's your apartment. Here's your wage. Do things to the best of your ability. We have an efficiency expert to tell you what to do. But the thing is, I don't think, like, mainland China was on the minds of the writers back in, like, 2001, 2002. But, I like the applicability of Star Trek at this point.
And maybe they just want to present it as envisioned and let us draw our own conclusions from it without, you know, taking the hardline stance that maybe TOS would have if they'd done the similar type of story.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
So, Ken, before we jump, any final thoughts on part one other than the fantastic cliffhanger that we're...
It was even worse than I remembered. Of just Chakotay outrunning security guards. Yeah. And he's up top. He's like, how's he going to get out of this? To be continued.
Well, you didn't have to wait 1 week at the time. You just kept binge watching.
Thank God. I was like breathless reaching for that disc.
I think... Like, it's weird, because in my memory, like, I don't remember waiting a week. I thought I watched them back to back, but I know I was watching Voyager as it aired.
Yeah.
So this, I don't know, I'm just, thank goodness that I only had to wait. I watched part one on, like, I think a Tuesday, and then I watched part two on, like, a Thursday.
Right,
it wasn't
right.
that much of a break for me, so it was fine.
Yeah.
It was not a good cliffhanger, because everything that happened in it was kind of artificial... story based.
Yeah, yeah.
It had nothing to do with any of the stakes that we have in the characters. It's just not a very good cliffhanger where it's random guards show up in an alley and Chakotay runs away from them. Like, who cares?
Yeah, and it almost felt like the Batman 1966 series where it like builds up this like, how's he going to get out of this? And then you see the payoff in part two and it's like the weakest, most unimpressive way to get out of the problem.
He shoots people.
Yeah.
Actually, I did like the idea of...
Well, he shorts out that circuit board or something.
He fooled them into thinking that he shorted out the circuit board to disrupt the force field, and then he jumped off the platform, and they're like, where did he go? And then he punches the guy in the back of the head.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, well...
But it's not staged the most excitingly.
It was staged by Roxanne Dawson.
That's true.
Who directed part two.
Yeah, it was Alan Croker did part one.
Yeah, and it was interesting to me, like, the first shot of one Roxanne Dawson directing herself... was her laying on a table sleeping, which, you know, got to do what you got to do as a director, I suppose.
Right, yeah.
So, mosey our way on to part two officially.
Yeah, this part introduces an interesting character of this investigator.
Yeah.
Who's played by Robert Joy, who's like a genre guy, because he's in the Hills Have Eyes remake. He's in George Romero's Land of the Dead. Underrated movie, by the way. And so as soon as he popped up, I was like, oh, yeah, this guy. And... it's interesting in that this episode is very much focusing on what happened to these crew members. You know, the first one's kind of throwing you into this world and trying to disorient you to a certain degree. Like, how did we wind up here?
World building.
Yeah, yeah, world building and just almost trying to, like, mix you up in this, like, how could this have happened? And then in part two, we get this investigator character working with Chakotay at points to try and figure out how it all happened and resolve it all.
Cam, did you ever see the movie... late 90s, I think, Chain Reaction starring Keanu Reeves.
Did I ever, and Morgan Freeman.
So, do you remember how Keanu Reeves is kind of like the patsy in this situation? He's framed for a crime that he didn't commit.
Yeah.
But the thing is, despite this cabal that's going on here, you have the cops investigating the situation, and the cops are smart.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. Like, even though they're on, you know, they're chasing down Keanu Reeves, they're like, if we're adding up the evidence, it doesn't seem as if this is the guy who did it. I like it when you have these situations and the investigators or the cops, law enforcement, they seem smart. They don't seem to be arbitrarily chasing someone just because that's how the movie set it up. And I like this investigator character who could have been such a throwaway, boring character that we've seen a million times in Star Trek before.
Or a villain.
Exactly. But they actually gave him critical thinking skills, which sometimes lacks in a lot of the antagonists that we see. And he wasn't an antagonist. He was like, oh, something is not right here with this planet that I'm living on. And I like it. The thing that doesn't work for me, though, is the guy's prosthetic makes him speak kind of strange.
Yeah.
I don't know what they could have done with that.
I've seen him in weirder prosthetics.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was the only thing that kind of, you know, took me out of the moment. Otherwise, I thought this is a very interesting bit player here in this episode.
He was an interesting character. I almost would have liked to have seen him in part one as well.
Yeah,
just build him up even more, because I thought he was actually... usually when they introduce a character in the second part,
nobody cares, right?
It's usually a very functional character who's there to just do something plot oriented, whereas like this character does do that, but there's actual character to him, and it feels like it's written with a level of care that usually would not be afforded to this type of character.
What did you think about the villain of the episode, Ralph Mouth from Happy Days?
Yeah, Don Most, right?
Yeah.
He's fine. He's pretty standard boilerplate stuff.
Like, what's his motivation, though? Like, doesn't it annoy you?
He's got a labor shortage.
He's got a labor shortage, and I'm being well compensated for wiping people's minds.
136 people they took from Voyager.
Yeah.
Do you think they got all of them out?
Well, okay, by the end of it, this conspiracy has unraveled, and Jennifer Aniston's father is saying, well, I'm glad we fixed the situation. I think they got everyone out at that point.
We should say, he really is Jennifer Aniston's father, the actor that plays the ambassador.
John Aniston.
Yeah.
He's like kind of like a soap opera star, a long career in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Did he get the special guest star treatment or like I think?
No. He was, I think, like second or third billed.
I think he got an and.
Oh, did he?
John Aniston.
Okay.
I think he did. Okay. Like I my eyes jumped open when I saw his name there. Not because of I saw the word John, but I think I saw something like and.
Yeah.
I don't know. Whatever. But I don't know. He was again. I like that he wasn't part of this cabal either. Yeah. Like I like how the oftentimes like alien planets in Star Trek are portrayed as very monolithic.
Mm-hmm.
I like when there's some diversity within.
Right.
It's not just one agenda on
right.
An
like they're not
planet.
All bad running under this Don Most character, Caden.
Yeah.
It's not like he speaks for the entire planet. Yeah. No, I thought that was good. But like the Don Most character, Caden, I mean, he reminded me a little bit of the Larry Drake character in Critical Care. Do you remember on the planet where it's like the medical system? The whole episode's a commentary on the medical system. I think the Larry Drake character was more well-drawn.
Yeah.
But
you can understand his motivation a lot more.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you understand that this villain character in this episode is more of just kind of a mouthpiece for the planet's problems and how he's going to solve them.
Does an episode like Critical Care work outside of the United States that well?
Well, I watched it and enjoyed it, and I'm not in the United States. But you mean like maybe like, more internationally?
In... You know, like developed economies that have universal healthcare systems, which is every single developed economy save for the United States.
Yeah.
I don't know if that one necessarily translates to international audiences, which, look, Star Trek is an American series. I get it. But to me, I think I was actually living in the United States when Critical Care happened. And all I could remember being like a Canadian child was like, in my country... I would not have to deal with this issue.
Right.
And then nobody at school
cared. You were young Janeway?
She was an inspiration to me. Yeah.
You had the bun and everything.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. So what did you think about maybe the ongoing... Okay. We've got this space-based stuff on board the ship. I love the shot of Voyager in that moon crater.
Oh, yeah. That was great. Yeah. It reminded me of... like something from Star Wars.
It really... Oh, I totally
had that.
Like the
Millennium Falcon on the asteroid.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Empire.
So it just kind of surprises me that how much you and I complained about the VFX in season one of Discovery, especially when we're looking at what they were able to do on Voyager in like by season seven.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it was such a weird experience when you and I watched Discovery on Blu-ray and all of a sudden the VFX seemed to actually be much better.
Right.
And season two VFX of Discovery, you and I didn't have complaints at all.
Nope.
It was such a weird experience. Yeah. Though. But in this situation, I can really appreciate the visuals that they're giving us with Voyager. It looks distinct. They're doing some cool stuff, and we appreciate that because I think we both agree the Berman era, not always the most visually dynamic.
No. I mean, this is coming... You know, after the big, like, DS9 finale and all that sort of stuff, the Dominion War, where you really see them pushing the envelope in terms of what they can do in, like, ship battles and stuff like that. But, like, moments like this feel like they're continuing the trend of doing interesting effects work. It doesn't feel like DS9 was the end point, and then they went back to kind of the rote stuff.
Well, I think they want to push themselves. I just think, an episode of Timeless...
Mm-hmm.
And just watching the crash landing on that ice planet that Voyager does, like, that is fantastic to watch even to this day.
Even, you know what, the entire world of workforce, you know, the whole, like, industrial setup of this workplace and, you know, its big elevators and all that sort of stuff. Like, it feels like there's effort gone into the design. You know, you could totally see how in an older Star Trek episode, they would have just thrown up a matte painting and been like, that's that.
Yeah.
You know, don't look too closely.
It would have been a matte painting that we have seen about four times before.
Sure.
As well.
Yeah. But they would have changed it for the special editions on Blu-ray.
Yeah. If I can pick on Creepy Tom a little bit more.
Yeah.
Remember the investigator comes by the bar and shows a picture of Seven? And Tom says, I wouldn't forget that face. And Seven is in the next room? Like, what the hell? Like, what a creepy thing to say.
I feel like Tom Paris is the character who always gets those types of lines.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Again, this is such a 90s kind of... Well, yeah. I mean, this episode is, I think, 2001. But still, it's just... It was a different era where you cannot get away saying that. Could you imagine if any of the Discovery characters said something like that? Like, who would be the most likely to do that at that point?
Lorca?
I guess Lorca?
Yeah, they would give that to a character like Lorca.
Yeah, but Pike's not going to say that. Saru's not going to say that. Stamets isn't going to say that. So I'm just like, okay, guys, like, I'm glad that we've evolved. We should ask RDM about all the toxic masculinity sort of lines that he had delivered. What's your favorite, sir?
I have a top five.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. What did you think of Jaffin's continued involvement in all this? Because he has a line where he's like, I've been involved in this since I met you. And you're like, a couple weeks?
Yeah. Well, you could tell he didn't want to pursue this initially when he was trying to gaslight Janeway.
Yes.
After her discussion with Chakotay. I loved all the Chakotay and Janeway interactions in part two. That was great stuff. But you know what? Okay, do I buy it? I guess so. He seems like somebody who genuinely cares for this woman that he's known for a short period of time.
Sure.
I guess all I can rationalize it as alien culture. Maybe some aliens are move in really quickly.
He's really, really invested in this.
Yeah.
Hugely invested in this.
Yeah.
And
hey, look, Janeway's a catch.
She is a catch, but I just wish that we had maybe more screen time to develop this or something.
Yeah.
Or maybe if they just spaced it out, like they've been gone longer. Like you could say that like Chakotay, Kim, and Neelix were gone longer. And, you know, the Voyager was supposed to be there for a period, of, like a longer period of time or something.
I could buy that. I could buy a month. If they just said a month.
Yeah, yeah.
Which could maybe mean 5 weeks.
Sure.
3 weeks seems...
Really stretching it. Yeah. Especially since we see the first meeting. And by the end of like probably the next 15 minutes, they're like moving in together.
Maybe there's a very good reason why Seven of Mine says no fraternizing.
Yeah, no kidding. This is really common down there.
Yeah, it just happens everything
People
so
are
quickly.
Constantly moving in together and then getting fights in the workplace. Yeah. And just, oh, it's chaos.
It makes it awkward. That's why you never date anybody you work with.
What just do you do there, though?
Bad idea.
Everyone works in the same place, it seems.
Yeah, that's true. You go hang out at the bar and you all have to hang out at the same bar, too.
I got a question then. Okay. So what's the HR like in this place?
Is Seven of Nine in charge of HR as well?
I don't know. Do they have HR?
It seems like she's kind of the closest thing that we have to HR.
Yeah.
She seems like she'd be brutal.
Yeah.
Like, have you had to deal with, like, bad HR people?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's just, like, really, like, all I'm asking is this question. I know I sound stupid to you, but can you help me out with this?
Yeah.
I was like, okay, you know, Seven is not the person I'd want to go to for clarity on my vacation hours.
Do you think they have good benefits?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I mean, well, actually, it seems as if they have a lot of doctors willing to, you know, work on patients any given moment you know, at the time. So maybe they do, actually. Maybe that's their justification for kidnapping people and wiping their memories.
Right.
Like, hey, we're giving them good lives. They try to justify it that way.
Well, speaking of wiping memories, what did you think of the whole thread with Tuvok being the one who realizes that something's up?
I like that. And, you know, and we get like a throwaway mention of Katra, how Tuvok had told a doctor at one point that they stole his Katra.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly how I interpreted what a Katra was, but I do like the shout out.
Mm-hmm.
But look, Tuvok is not well served in most of the two-parters, I'd say. I think they've given him more in this one than anything else, and I think they like the idea that he's a little bit unnerved. Well, more than a little bit unnerved, you know. And so I think that lets him stretch a little bit, and it works for me.
It also shows him being very vulnerable, which we never see in Tuvok.
Yeah.
Tuvok is like the stiffest Vulcan character we've ever had on Star Trek as a main character. Like, you look at, like, T'Pol and Spock, they got to play much broader ranges of emotions, you know, pardon the pun for Vulcan emotions
But
they just got to, you know, really explore many more facets of their personality as those characters. Tuvok was often just stiff, dependable Tuvok.
Well, he fell into the Beltran thing where it's like, firing phases, Captain. It's like, okay.
But I like how in this one he's introduced doing this hearty laugh. And then he's like the character who realizes what's up. He's like the Tom Wilkinson and Michael Clayton character. You know, he's the one who's running around being like, I know the truth. I know the truth.
Yeah.
And his fate isn't as grim as that character.
That's
but,
true. Yeah.
But I mean, I like the sense that we're getting to see him active and vulnerable, which are two things that Tuvok doesn't usually get to do.
So, Kim, are you saying that we should have swapped one redhead out for another redhead as the main antagonist in this particular episode?
So we're swapping out Don Most.
For Tilda Swinton?
Oh!
From Michael Clayton?
I think you always make the swap for Tilda Swinton. I think Don Most would agree to that swap.
Yeah, fair enough. So I'll ask him that question in Las Vegas next time I see him.
But I really like, too, the moment where he has the mind meld with Seven as well. And that's what kind of wakes her up as well, is having these memories of the Borg. And so I just thought that was really cool imagery.
I'm sure it was like something like we've seen before. Like it was
the
probably,
Borg footage?
Yeah, it's probably from their archives, some sort of filter on it. But
it was in another episode, I believe.
It was probably like Dark Frontier, maybe.
Probably.
You know, I don't care. I love seeing it. It's always
probably
cool.
Would have been one closer to that episode, right? Maybe like Unimatrix Zero or something?
Could be, yeah. Let's go rewatch all of them and determine exactly which one. Yeah.
Take it piece by piece, yeah.
Yeah. So with regards to the resolution of this, look, very rarely Voyager gives a lot of space for resolution. It's usually like, hey, flash, bang,
yeah, exploding
let's
blow consoles
up
and
the bridge, and then the episode is resolved. They give us, what, like 5 minutes to kind of wrap up a lot of the storylines, whether it's the B'Elanna and Tom stuff where, you know, B'Elanna goes into her quarters with Neelix earlier on in the episode and sees that old antique TV.
Why does he have an antique TV?
She gave it to him.
I understand that, but why an antique TV? Who wants an antique TV?
He is a 20th century pop culture nut. That's been well established before.
Do you think people now are watching antique TVs?
Well, no, but like, I don't know. Like, I could picture somebody now wanting to have
I guess it's kind of like
an old baby grand piano or something like that from like 1750.
Or I guess like people that collect like the vintage arcade games.
Yeah.
I guess it makes sense.
I can buy that.
Yeah.
What I don't understand is Tom watching this TV, watching the least funny cartoons I've ever seen, and him going,
like really chuckling. I like the one too where he chuckles and looks away. And it's like this weird reaction shot to the cartoon.
RDM wishes he had a second take. I just wonder if they went with his first take and he wishes he could have done another.
I mean, if I'm B'Elanna, I'm really questioning my life choices.
Yeah.
I'm just like,
this is the father of my child. This is what he finds funny.
It's borderline Homer Simpson.
It seemed as if he was forcing his laughter. It's just like,
I mean, I
it's like this
I'm trying
strange
to remember the
woman who I have a big crush on
yeah.
is saying, hey, you like to watch this. Sit down and watch this with popcorn. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Ah-ha-ha.
I'm trying to remember the blocking of the scene. He probably didn't know what he was watching, did he?
I don't think he did.
Yeah, so it's more like you're reacting to cartoons that are funny.
Did you know what he was watching? I looked at the cartoon. All I could tell was like it was probably produced in like the 1940s or 50s.
I was thinking maybe like a Max Fleischer cartoon or something.
It just looks so indistinct. And
I would say like a early vintage like Disney, but I don't think so. I don't think they would be airing Disney stuff on a CBS show.
At least with, say, the Short Trek Calypso, we had kind of the Betty Boop cartoons that were very distinct and recognizable, and I could appreciate this is just some rando cartoon that I was just like, I just shrugged, it meant nothing to me.
We've said that, now we're gonna look it up and it's like the all-time hailed like animation work of that era.
Yeah.
Like that was one of the shorts that changed the industry.
Cam, I think as all longtime listeners know, you and I are doofuses and we're wrong a lot. Actually, so
that I got a funny story non-Star Trek related of Tyler, where you and I went and saw Nine Inch Nails and they had a bassist on stage. And Nine Inch Nails, as people who don't follow Nine Inch Nails may not know, is they rotate the touring band all the time.
Yeah.
And there was this bassist in the group, and you were like, who is this guy? He does not fit them at all.
Okay, but Cam, he had zero stage presence.
Zero stage presence. You're just like, he's just some nobody. Who knows who this hired gun is? And then we look him up after. He's like one of the all-time great session bassists.
I felt like an idiot. Like, I really did.
You were seeing a living legend on stage whose name I don't know.
I know. I'm blanking. But the thing is, like, if you look him up, you would recognize so many of the albums that he's appeared on.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, he is, like, well, like, you've got John Paul Jones, you've got Paul McCartney, then I think you've got this guy, like, when it comes to bassists. And I'm like, oh, okay.
It was so great.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's how I felt with this cartoon. I feel like if I look it up, it's going to be something, like, all-time famous.
Yeah. Okay. Look, I alluded to it a few moments ago, but the Jaffin Janeway resolution, I do appreciate that. Because initially, Janeway just is transported, and he starts, like, squeezing, like, the sparkles of the transporter as she's, like, brought away. And I was like, oh, snap, he doesn't get any sort of resolution with this woman he deeply cares about.
I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, that's really cold if they leave this character there.
Janeway planned it the whole time. That's 24th century ghosting right there.
Beam me up, wingman.
Look, I like the fact that he got to drop into her quarters and be like, I can see why you want to leave. And you know, this is why he kind of stood out as like one of the more memorable love interests that Janeway's had.
What is the story of this character?
Where does he go from here?
Yeah, because he's just like, I got a good job. I got a promotion.
Wouldn't he rather want to hang out as an engineer even if he can't be with Janeway?
Or even just take a ride somewhere.
Yeah.
Be like, drop me off at the next system.
Believe me, I wouldn't want to be hanging out on like this console day in, day out, going to the most boring bar in the world, you know?
Which really does then lead me to wonder whether this planet is supposed to be at least positive in terms of how it operates.
Well, I think it's meant to be that way because they make it very clear it's a multicultural planet.
Yep.
And I go back to the fact that often planets in Star Trek are showcased as very monolithic. Mm-hmm. So I kind of appreciate that there is some complexity going on this planet here. I really do appreciate these sorts of nuances that are in this episode.
It feels like they were actually thinking about the actual planet.
Yeah.
Which, you know, sometimes isn't the case.
Any final thoughts on part two before we kind of wrap up our overall thoughts on this one?
I will say, like, I found a lot of the techno jargon stuff in terms of how they were going to get out of there not the most interesting to sit through.
Yeah.
Which is not uncommon in some of these Star Trek stories where it's just like characters spitting out techno babble.
There are some fun sequences, like with the Doctor blowing up a torpedo, or else having those escape pods self-destructing. You know, there's some stuff we haven't seen in Star Trek before.
True. So I was going to say, though, I did enjoy some of the character stuff we got with B'Elanna, where she is recovering.
Yeah.
On Voyager, we find out she likes pancakes with maple syrup.
Sure. And she likes reading her husband's private diaries.
Yeah.
I don't think that's cool at all.
I don't know what their relationship's like. I'm not going to judge.
Okay.
Maybe, like, he reads hers, she reads his.
But the thing is, at that point, she didn't know what their relationship was like either.
It's true. Yeah.
I don't think that's cool, B'Elanna. Yeah. Sorry. So, just saying.
But, like, B'Elanna's a character we often don't get that sort of good stuff out of. Whereas I like that this was just getting to see her kind of stripped down and rebuilding herself as an individual. I thought that was really interesting to see.
Keep trying to think about what must be in Tom Paris's diaries. My guess is, you know, back in like junior high, if you had a crush on somebody, all you do is write their name nonstop on like a sheet of paper.
Yeah.
I bet his entire diary is B'Elanna Torres, B'Elanna Torres, B'Elanna Torres.
Well, we also found out in Threshold he used to cry in his room a lot. So maybe it's like also some of the diaries is from that era too.
Whoa. Cam, I'm flipping through your diary. Why is my name written everywhere here in your little notebook that I've got? Okay. I'm flattered.
Now I'm going to go home and watch my antique TV.
Okay. Cam, wrapping up here. Look, I was not really looking forward to this one. I thought we would be ridiculing this.
Yeah.
We've really been praising Workforce Parts 1 and 2.
Yeah. Like, I don't love it, but I can admire it.
It seems like a low-key sort of two-part episode, but I can appreciate it. And, okay, does it justify itself as a two-part episode? That's always the question that we come around to. And ultimately, I like so much of the character stuff here.
Yeah.
I would not want them to compress this story into one episode. And I think you and I were split with regards to Flesh and Blood, the previous two-parter for Voyager.
Yeah.
I thought it could have been one episode. You liked a lot of the character stuff, which I did too, but which is why you wanted it as a two-parter.
Yeah.
I'd say this totally justifies itself solely for the character stuff as a two-part episode for me.
I think you could rewrite this episode to be a single episode. You would, strip out some of the character stuff, as you said. And I think you would probably have it more like from the point of view of Chakotay coming back and finding Voyager gone and stumbling across them on this planet. And you would have the story start from there. But in terms of being a two-parter, I think it does, because it doesn't feel like they're wasting time.
Yeah.
And that's something I feel in some of the two-parters that we've maybe said don't justify themselves. This feels like when they sat down and wrote it, they had very specific beats they wanted to hit for part one and for part two. I feel like they did that, and it holds together as a solid, you know, hour and a half long Voyager adventure. So, yeah, it justifies itself.
Okay.
For sure.
Overall, I mean, I can't wait until... Okay, we've got Endgame to go.
Yeah.
We'll do that in August. And then in September, we're going to rank all the two-parters. I'm genuinely intrigued about where this one is ultimately going to land for us. I suspect closer to the middle than the top.
Yeah.
But that's not to say it's a bad episode. I think we both genuinely liked it a lot more than we were expecting to going into it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, what's our biggest critique of it at this point? I mean, there's some silly stuff with Tom, you know, right. But beyond that, like,
I think just its low keyness,
yeah,
is maybe a strike against it for people who look to the two-parters to be really, like, memorable, outside-the-norm type stories.
Especially in you are in your final season,
yeah,
and this is your last big two-part adventure before you go to the series finale. I wonder if maybe that's why this one didn't quite work for me when I was watching it at the time.
Well, there's really, I mean, outside of Endgame, which we haven't revisited yet, there's no big home run two-parters. Because you have the second part of Unimatrix Zero.
Yeah.
And then you have the one we just did recently, Flesh and Blood.
Yeah.
And then we've got this one. Yeah. And, like, I really enjoyed Flesh and Blood, but, like, it's hard to go to bat for it competing against things like Scorpion or Year of Hell.
Yeah.
So it is interesting that Season 7 does feel much more low-key in terms of its big event stories.
So I think I kept saying throughout this episode that this one aired in 2001, but if Flesh and Blood was the previous one, I think this must have been a 2002 episode. I could be wrong,
yeah.
But just want to put it out there that I'm trying to keep my dates straight here.
Right, right.
So,
anyway. Yeah. So, again, like, Workforce, I am curious what its perception is with most Voyager fans. Like, if they really like it, or if it's one that they kind of go like, oh, yeah, that was something.
Well, you and I think it was something.
Something special. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Okay, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cam, we are tackling best alternate actors in Star Trek. So think about all the primary big name characters that we know. There always seems to be maybe a flashback episode or like an alternate sort of universe where you're getting a different actor playing that character. And it's actually kind of fun to dive in, whether it's like a child actor or whether it's like some sort of doppelganger or what have you. This is going to be kind of a fun one for us to dive into.
My name is James Tiberius Kirk.
Spoiler, that's my number one.
Okay, so you can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Voice Command Voyager Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R-E-P-O-R-T. T as in Tom's Unfunny Cartoons. O-N.
Classics of the form. Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed. Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. 9 to 5 for service and devotion. You would think that I would deserve a fair promotion. Transfer complete.